Hey, this is Leo for actualized.org. And in this episode, I'm going to be talking about mystical traditions around the world and the many diverse names for enlightenment. So as we embark on our mission to become more sage-like, I thought that a very appropriate topic would be to put our work to become sages into a broader context, into a historical context. What is it that sages have been up to for the last 5,000 years? And that's exactly it, is that sages and mystics have been doing this work for at least 5,000 years, and probably even much earlier than that. We just don't have very good historical records. There's not much new under the sun here. So we're going to take a nice deep look into what's really going on. And this can be very eye-opening to understand that the spiritual purification work that you're doing, the self-actualization work, any sort of self-help techniques, any meditative techniques, any kind of new age stuff that you're into or that you're reading about, you got to realize that this goes back at least 5,000 years, and that every single culture on every single continent, except Antarctica, maybe, has understood these truths and has been engaging in this process of essentially what? Essentially self-discovery and truth realization. That's the essence of it. So let's take a look at religion and specifically the mystical kernels, the mystical cores of every religion. Religion these days gets a bad rap. And understandably so, and I'm not a big fan of religion, except we don't want to throw the baby out with the bathwater. And here's the problem that a lot of rational people make when they talk about religion, is that they forget the mystical core at the center of every religion. And it's actually very shocking when you start to study mysticism historically. It's very shocking and very eye-opening to see the amount of consensus and agreement between every single mystical tradition on every continent, in every country, in every city around the world, throughout thousands of years of different cultures, different political climates, different geological activity. Like, there's so much diversity around the world. And yet, if we take a look and we do a real deep study of mysticism, we see that actually there's a lot of common elements. Here are the commonalities. Every mystical tradition and every religion is ultimately grounded upon the notion of searching for existential truth. Truth with a capital T. Even the idea that there is such a thing and that such a thing is accessible to the human creature. That's what all mysticism is based upon. And this existential truth is simply the question of what is existence itself? How come existence exists? This is the most basic and fundamental question that you could possibly ask. And you better believe that even though our ancestors thousands of years ago were living in caves, they didn't even have cities yet. They didn't even have agriculture. But nevertheless, they were asking this question. What is existence? And what's really amazing is that they discovered the answer to this. And the answer to this is also common to all mystical traditions. And the answer is basically that existence is a unity. It's a formlessness. It's a pure potential energy. It's a void, which is what non-duality means. And it's an absolute infinite singularity. Now, those are just words, just ideas, just beliefs. The important thing to understand here is that these are not actually beliefs, but this is actually an experience that one can have. And that's what all mysticism is predicated upon, is having this experience for oneself, which is what differentiates mysticism from religion. Religion is about beliefs and rituals, whereas mysticism is about having this experience for yourself. Recognizing that this experience is fundamentally ineffable and transcendent and impossible to communicate, impossible to believe, impossible to rationally understand, or to write down in a book. And this is what leads to esoteric knowledge, which is another common element among all the mystical traditions. Esotericism, which basically means a sort of hidden knowledge. Knowledge that is not revealed to just every Joe Schmo on the street. Because this knowledge, this is knowledge of the divine. This is knowledge of existence itself. Now, why is this knowledge kept hidden? Not because we have some kind of conspiracy theory going on and we want to be elitists and we want to hold this knowledge back. No, it's not that. Actually, true mystics love to spread mysticism. The problem, though, is what happens when the ego gets a hold of esoteric knowledge. When the ego gets a hold of esoteric knowledge, it really turns into a lot of bad stuff, which is why religion has such a bad rap. And also, the reason the knowledge has to be esoteric is because, well, we're persecuted for this knowledge. Even nowadays, it's very easy to get criticized for espousing this knowledge. But if you did it 100 years ago, 500 years ago, let alone 2,000 years ago, you were liable to get crucified, burned at the stake, stoned to death, beheaded, tortured, raped, your family killed, and exterminated, right? Or exiled or excommunicated from your community. That's the reality. And that basically still goes on today around the world. So that's why this knowledge had to be esoteric. Another reason the knowledge had to be esoteric is because by its very nature, it's paradoxical and ineffable. And so you can't grasp it the way you can normal knowledge. You can't just write it down in a textbook the way you can with a mathematical formula or some scientific theorem. And so we see esoteric knowledge, hidden knowledge, the mysteries, these mystery schools and sects all around the world from all these different traditions. Another common element of all mysticism is altered states of consciousness, the recognition that there's more than just two states the way we normally think. It's not just dreaming and waking consciousness. There's something else. There's many other states of consciousness, and all mystical traditions in one way or another understand this, and they actually pursue these altered states of consciousness. And they don't hold waking everyday consciousness as the most true and absolute of the states. And the way that they pursue this, here's another common element of among all traditions, is through meditation, contemplation, and prayer. Now, prayer is interesting. Most people think of prayer as praying for God to give me something that I need. That's not true prayer. True prayer is more like contemplation or meditation. And you'll see that if you start to study serious mysticism. So there's a variety of techniques, hundreds if not thousands of different meditation and contemplation and prayer techniques have been developed in all cultures around the entire world throughout the last 5,000 years. And you can go study them and you can use them to attain these altered states of consciousness and ultimately to reach the highest understanding of absolute truth. Other common elements of mystical traditions, really quickly, is the purification of materialistic cravings. That's a common element. Why? Because materialism is the biggest thing that stands in the way of this ineffable knowledge. Also, there's a strong emphasis on ego transcendence. Why? Because the ego is the biggest thing that stands in the way between you and this knowledge. There's also strong emphasis on mind transcendence. Again, because the mind is the biggest obstacle. There is a strong emphasis on cultural transcendence, because culture is a very big obstacle. There's a strong emphasis on wisdom and intuition over logic and rationality. Why is that? Because the deepest truth is not accessible to logic and rationality, but only to spontaneous divine insight or intuition. There's also a strong emphasis on unconditional love. You see this embodied by all the greatest mystics. Unconditional love. This is actually the characteristic that makes them so magnetic and charming and charismatic that they're able to draw crowds of thousands of people around them who are very loyal supporters. How are they able to do that? Not by brainwashing their followers, but by radiating unconditional love, which is an honest signal. You want an honest signal of enlightenment? It's unconditional love. There is no more honest signal of mastery of the truth than unconditional love. When you can love everything and everyone indiscriminately, that is the true hallmark sign of a master. And that's a very rare thing. And this thing cannot be faked easily. Actually, it can't be faked at all. It's very easy to see an individual who is not capable of unconditional love. Individuals who are capable of unconditional love are so rare that if you ever meet one, you've probably never met one, but if you ever meet one, you will understand how religions get started. Because this is such a powerful and palpable thing that when you encounter it for the first time in your life, you will be floored. Floored at the mastery that this individual has to exhibit unconditional love. On the one hand, it's a very simple thing. On the other hand, you're so far from it right now that it almost seems inhuman. Another common element is happiness, bliss, and goodness. These are commonly emphasized in mystical traditions. And here, happiness, of course, is not a materialistic form of happiness or hedonism, but a deeper, much, 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 much deeper, unconditional form of happiness. And all of this is grounded, you have to understand, is grounded in direct experience. It's a big mistake to think that this comes from just blind faith or from belief or from brainwashing yourself with affirmations and with prayer. No, 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 no. You cannot get these things through any of that. You can only get a veneer, a fake veneer of it through affirmations and through prayer and through faith, but not the real deal. And the real deal is so much greater than the thin veneer. So what I want to introduce you to is the many different traditions that we have around the world that are related to mysticism and that ultimately turned into religions, right? So these traditions, I have to just gloss over them because I can't go into depth on all of them. But the point here is that I want you to get a big picture understanding, a survey of the land, so to speak, so that you can see how all of this interconnects. That's what I'm trying to show you here, the similarity between all these traditions. So we have Christianity. Within Christianity, we have many, many, many different sects and groups. And the mystical core of Christianity is Gnosticism, Eastern Orthodox, various monastic orders like the Franciscan monks, the Benedictine monks, and there are many, many, many orders of different monks. And these people, these were the original old school Christians, and they understood what Christianity was really about. It's not what it's about these days. It's a totally different thing, right? It's about enlightenment. Also, in India, we have everything related to Hinduism. We have Hinduism. We have a diversity, this kind of evolutionary diaspora of spirituality happening in the Indian subcontinent. We have Hinduism. We have many different forms of yoga. And by yoga, of course, I don't mean the physical yoga that you see here in Western gyms, mostly women working out, not that. I'm talking about old school, serious contemplative yoga. There's many forms of yoga. There's also the Advaita Vedanta tradition, which is all about enlightenment, very direct method for enlightenment. There's the Shaiva Tantra tradition, which is pretty old. It's about 1,500 years old, goes back to ancient India. And there's Sikhism, which is a smaller sect also found in India. And there's a religion called Jainism, which is actually a very beautiful spiritual tradition if you study up on it. Most people don't know what Jainism is, but the founder of it was Mahavira. Actually predated the Buddha and a really amazing, remarkable mystic. So that's going on in India primarily. Of course, we've also got Buddhism, which you should probably be already familiar with. And in Buddhism, we have many different strands and sects. We have Zen, we have Tibetan Dzogchen, there's Theravada, there's Mahayana, there's Vajrayana. And those are just the big categories. Then within each of those, you have a lot of different subgroups and subsects and so forth. So, of course, Buddhism is from northern India, but mostly then China and southern Asia and Japan. We also have Taoism, which has some remarkable sages and mystics in it. And that's sort of similar to Buddhism, although different. Then, interestingly, what a lot of people don't know about is Islam. So Islam is most definitely founded upon true mystical insights, and the mystical core of Islam is Sufism. Sufism. Then we have the Jewish traditions, and the Jewish tradition's mystical kernel is Kabbalah. Then we have the Greeks. I'm talking about the ancient Greeks. And you better believe that the ancient Greeks knew a thing or two about non-duality. Not all of them. But many of the ancient Greek philosophers knew a little bit about non-duality, if not a lot. Heraclitus, for example, was truly enlightened. Plotinus, obviously enlightened. Then we have the Eleusinian Mysteries, which were happening in Greece and in Rome for over 2,000 years. Imagine this. 2,000 years, the Eleusinian Mysteries were revealing mystical secrets to initiates that were joining this secret cult. And there were all sorts of other cults throughout Europe and throughout that area of the world in that time. Of course, we've got the ancient Egyptians, and they really took spirituality to a whole new level. In fact, we don't know that much about the Egyptians, but just based on speculation, you better believe that the Egyptians knew a thing or two about non-duality in one way or another. There's also, even dating further back than that, we've got various forms of paganism and shamanism, which is still found around the world, especially in the Americas, in the South Americas, in the North Americas. We have all sorts of paganism, shamanism. We have various Native American traditions, which are very spiritually oriented. And so the shamans and pagans and the Native Americans, they all had their own little twists on things, and they definitely had some sort of mystical insights upon which they developed their rituals and practices and their beliefs. And then in more modern times, we have the New Age. And the New Age movement, you could think of it starting like with the Transcendentalists a couple hundred years ago. Then there was Theosophy, teachings of people like Aleister Crowley, which get into more occult subjects. And then you have people like Gurdjieff, Uspensky, and so forth. So there's a lot of reinventing of the wheel happening in the last 200 years in Europe and in America because, well, this is a perennial thing, right? It never dies out. This is an evergreen subject matter. What is the nature of existence? And everybody puts their own little twist on things. Sometimes it seems like all these traditions and all these different people and all these different teachings are all so different and they're all so conflicting and so contradictory. But if you take a look and you study this and you really zoom out and you ask yourself, what's going on the highest elevation perspective? You clearly see that there's actually a lot of convergence, and the convergence is actually very shocking. You would think that people in India have nothing to do with people in South America, have nothing to do with people in North America, have nothing to do with people in Africa, have nothing to do with people in China, have nothing to do with people in Europe, and that their cultures are so different that they would come up with all sorts of crazy different theories and stories about what existence is. And yet that's not the case. It can seem that way on the surface, but deep down, actually, they all say exactly the same thing, which is that it's all one thing. It's all a unity. It's all infinity. It's all void. It's all emptiness. And that's what I want to get into a little bit here. Because see, I'm not a scholar of all of these different traditions, and we don't have time, frankly, right here, right now, to get into each of these traditions and to show you all the different stuff that's there. What I want to point you to is doing the research and doing the study. I want to get you kind of interested and aware that this field of study exists, and you can go and you can do lots of research on your own. You can buy books, you can read, and in fact, I'll give you some resources at the end of this episode for doing just that. So I'm not going to cover in depth all these different traditions, but what I do want to do is I want to talk about the different names for enlightenment and God that these traditions have. I think that this is valuable, because once you see that they are all basically talking about the exact same thing, using just different labels and different symbols, then that's an important step in your evolution to sagehood. Very important step. Now, one caveat when I talk about God, all right, now this word God, I really, in a sense, don't like this word. I have a love-hate relationship with the word God. When I talk about the word God, don't make the mistake of thinking that I'm talking about some bearded man in the clouds who sits in judgment of you and is somehow separate from and distinct from reality. No, that's a childish notion of God. I'm talking about the original mystical notion of God. God is simply another word for reality or existence. So that includes you, and that includes me, and that includes the whole world. But not just that. God specifically refers to an understanding or a direct experience of what the nature of existence or reality is, fundamentally. Why does existence exist? And believe it or not, it is possible to answer this question, and this is not an intellectual matter. This is not a belief that you have that you read in a book. This is something that you discover through the right contemplative and meditative practices, right? So keep that in mind. So what I'm going to give you here now is a list of over 50 names that I've assembled. I've been assembling this list for months now across all the different traditions that I've studied. So obviously we have enlightenment. We have God. We have truth. That's truth with a capital T. We have the absolute. We have infinity. Consciousness, awareness, presence, no self, the true self, oneness, nothingness, non-duality, ego death, self-transcendence, self-realization. Now remember that all of these words are just labels that are essentially pointing to the exact same thing. But you're not quite sure what it's pointing to yet. The whole idea behind this is that these words are pointers pointing to something ineffable, something that other human beings have discovered that you have not yet discovered for yourself. And these human beings are telling you, hey, there's something very powerful, ineffable, that can be discovered that I'm pointing to with these words. And if you want, you can go and discover for yourself. Okay, so keep that in mind as I'm going down this list. So I said self-realization. We also have awakening, liberation, revelation, illumination, ecstasy, rebirth, cessation, Holy Spirit, gnosis, which is defined as knowledge of the mystical. That's where we get Gnostics, the Christian Gnostics from. You know, the word knowledge itself, where does that come from? Well, it starts with knowledge, gno, to know. See, gnosis, to know. That's the same root word. And you know, the word ignorant, ignorant, what does that mean? That literally means a lack of mystical knowledge. Ignorance is a lack of true understanding of reality. We also have the word Godhead, which specifically points to the impersonal essence of God, the what of God, what God is. That's the Godhead. We also have words from the Christian mystical tradition like theosis, which is defined as a transformative process whose goal is union with God. We also have kenosis, which is defined as an emptying of oneself and freeing yourself of your own will so that you have room for God's will. There's agape, which is a Greek term that means divine love, as distinguished from erotic love or the love that a father has for his child, let's say, or brotherly love. This is divine love, agape. From the Hindu tradition, we've got Atman and Brahman. These are classical terms. I love these terms. Atman basically means the I am or the individualized self, true self. And Brahman means the universal self or the unchanging reality amidst and beyond the world. It's the ground of everything. We also have terms like the void, emptiness, nirvana, which literally means a blowing out or a quenching. Yoga, which literally means a union with God or with reality. Moksha, which is defined as a deliverance from the wheels of birth and death, a sort of liberation from the illusion of life. Buddha mind. Kensho, which is a Zen term, which means seeing into one's true nature. Satori, also a Zen term, which means a lasting realization of the true nature of existence. Stream entry, that's a popular Buddhist term for one who has had a first glimpse of the nature of himself. Arahat, which is a title given to a fully awakened master. Fruition, which basically means the fruition of all your meditative and contemplative practices, which is enlightenment. Then we have words like prajna, which means the highest and purest form of wisdom, intelligence, and understanding. We have a word called jnana, which means insight or pure awareness free of any conceptual encumbrances. We have sunyata, which means emptiness or voidness. We have a Hindu term, turiya, which means the pure background consciousness that is the stage for all of existence. We have a Tibetan term, rigpa, which means knowledge of the ground of all being. What is being grounded in? That's rigpa. We also have bodhi, which is the root word that we get Buddha from. The Buddha means an awakened one, and bodhi means awakening to the true nature of things. Bud means to wake up, to awaken. From the Taoist tradition, we have wuji, or wu, which means basically nothingness, the ultimate boundless infinity that is reality. From the Zen tradition, we also have the word mu. Mu is a common response that Zen masters give to koans, to Zen koans. And what does mu mean? It means nothingness, or the original non-being that is existence. We also have nirvikalpa samadhi, which is an Indian term, which means the ultimate form of samadhi, an absorption without self-consciousness to such a degree that a distinction between the knower, the act of knowing, and the object known becomes dissolved, and one is left with an undifferentiated cognition. There's also sahaja samadhi, which is a very deep, advanced level of samadhi where you have a recognition that all of identity, the identity of spirit and of matter, of subject and object, is one, and that there is no more sacred or profane, there's no more spiritual or material, but that everything lives in a pure void. Then we have the word Shiva. Shiva refers to a popular major Indian deity. It's like the god is Shiva. But what is Shiva? Shiva is not some avatar or some man living in the clouds in heaven. Shiva means nothingness. That's literally what Shiva is. God is nothingness. I love that word, Shiva. When you actually experience it, all these words will make sense to you. Right now, it might seem a little crazy, but wait till you actually experience Shiva for yourself. That's an amazing thing. Speaking of that, Satchitananda is another word, which is a beautiful phrase that perfectly describes the experience of God or Shiva. Satchitananda is defined as existence, consciousness, bliss. It's a three-part description of what it feels like to experience ultimate reality. And I found in my own experiences of ultimate reality that it's a very apt description. That's exactly how you feel. At the same time, you understand existence, consciousness, and you're overwhelmed with a feeling of bliss and love. There's also a popular favorite phrase of mine, rather, Ein Sof, which comes to us from the Kabbalistic tradition, Judaism. And Ein Sof means the zero, the absolute zero, that which has no end or infinity. I love how the Kabbalists talk about zero and infinity. It's very beautiful. Of course, from the Islamic traditions, we have Allah. And Allah possesses a quality called Tawheed. What is Tawheed? It's the indivisible oneness that is God, that ineffable oneness of God that can't be encapsulated in any form. And then another very beautiful phrase that I love from the Sufi tradition is fana al fana, which is defined as the passing away of the passing away. It's a non-duality so deep that even non-duality falls away. It's a complete and utter annihilation of everything, of the self and of everything that remains after the self and of any ideas that you are enlightened or that you are God, or that you've experienced the ultimate truth. It's a complete passing away of everything. It's to die before one has died. Fana al fana. And that's what we're all ultimately after here, is fana al fana. So this is the list. Over 50 different labels, all talking about the same thing, essentially. Now, we could split hairs, and we could say, well, Nirva Kalpa Samadhi, Leo, Nirva Kalpa Samadhi is technically different from Rigpa, and Rigpa is technically different from Fana Al Fana, and that's technically different from... Yeah, we can get into those debates. And once you reach higher levels of attainment, spiritual attainment, then maybe it will be worthwhile for you to make those distinctions. But right now, for most people, that's not important, right? Try to see the commonality here, rather than the little differences. So what I want to do now is I've selected three mystics from three different traditions that you've probably never heard of that I want to quote to you from so that you can get a little taste of the similarity here and how we're always talking about the exact same thing, just using different styles and different language. And I specifically selected mystics that you've probably never heard of before, probably from traditions that you've never even known existed. Why? Because I want to show you how much breadth and depth there is to this, and that it really is worthwhile for you to dig in a little bit deeper, to do a little bit more research on your own. It's fascinating stuff. So, without further ado, let me quote to you, firstly from Rabbi Azriel of Gerona, who is a 12th century Kabbalist Jewish mystic. Here's what he writes. Quote, "If a questioner asks, who can compel me to believe in Ein Sof? What do we say?" And he says, quote, "Know that everything visible and perceivable to human contemplation is limited, and everything that is limited is finite, and that everything that is finite is insignificant. Conversely, that which is not limited is called Ein Sof, and it is absolutely undifferentiated in a complete and changeless unity. And if he is without limit, then nothing exists outside of him. And since he is both exalted and hidden, He is the essence of all that is concealed and revealed. End quote. Next, I want to read to you from Pseudo-Dionysius the Areopagite, a 6th century Eastern Orthodox Christian mystic. Here's what he has to say. Quote, God is therefore known in all things and distinct from all things. He is known through knowledge and through unknowing. Of him there is conception, reason, understanding, touch, perception, opinion, imagination, and name, and many other things. On the other hand, he cannot be understood. Words cannot contain him, and no name can lay hold of him. He is not one of the things that are, and he cannot be known in any of them. He is all things in all things, and he is no thing among things. He is known to all from all things, and he is known to no one from anything. End quote. Oh, I love that. I love the paradox of that. How about that for confusion? And lastly, let me quote to you from Ibn Ataillah, 13th century Sufi Islamic mystic, who writes, quote, how can the heart be illumined while the forms of creatures are reflected in its mirror? Or how can it journey to God while shackled by its passions? Or how can it desire to enter the presence of God while it has not yet purified itself of the strain of forgetfulness? Or how can it understand the subtle points of mysteries while it has not yet repented of its offenses? While on the way to Allah, one can experience flashes or illuminations, but only when one has accomplished fana al-fana, the passing away of the passing away, only then can one see in the light of Allah himself. The real is not veiled from you, rather it is you who are veiled from seeing it. For were anything to veil it, then that which veils it would cover it. But if there were a covering to it, then it would be a limitation to its being. Every limitation to anything has power over it. But he is the omnipotent above his servants. End quote. I want to give credit to Professor Luke Timothy Johnson of Emory University, who is a professor of mysticism and religion, from whom I pulled 3 of these quotes. So there you have it. You're getting a little bit of a taste of the diversity of styles and ways of communicating about the ineffable source of all of reality. So you might wonder, well, why am I telling you all this? What's the significance here? Sounds just like interesting trivia. It's more than just interesting trivia, though. What I want from you is I want you to become fluent in non-duality to such a degree that you have integrated, holistic understanding of this entire field, so that you see the ultimate picture, so that you are able to converse fluently with a Christian or a Jew or a Muslim or a Buddhist or a Hindu or an atheist or an occultist, or if you got into a time machine and you traveled back in time 5,000 years ago to the ancient Egyptians, you would be able to understand where they're coming from. And so that you see how all of this interconnects and how all of it basically points to the exact same thing. Of course, allowing for a lot of diversity and a lot of stylistic differences, you have to understand that all of these mystics and all these traditions were started in totally different corners of the world, on different continents, different climates, different geopolitical situations, different city-state situations, wars, factions, famines, different cuisines, you know, different ways of storytelling, different languages. So that accounts for a lot of the differences. But even still, if you overlook the differences, you see the incredible similarities. And this is something that you need as a sage And this is something that you need to really master, this field of non-duality. Because you know what? I've met enlightened people. I've even met enlightened masters who are still ignorant of one or more of these traditions and who react in a petty, sectarian sort of way against Muslims or Buddhists or Hindus or Christians or Jews because they don't see, they haven't really studied the that tradition. And so they can't see the interconnections that it has to their enlightenment. And so therefore they actually are not fully masters. I don't consider them masters. I consider them only having partial understanding of the entire field. Right? This is one of the things I mean when I say enlightenment is way more than just about enlightenment. Right? Because it's very easy to get enlightened and then look at the entire world from your little corner or your little perspective, from your little culture. It's like you become enlightened and then it's like the Buddhist way of enlightenment is the only way. It's the highest way. And then if you're a Christian, then it's your Christian way that's the only way. And if you're a Hindu, it's your Hindu way that's the only way. And this to me speaks of ignorance, right? Just downright ignorance. Because you can tell that these people, even if they do have some kind of higher spiritual realizations or insights, that's great. But also it's important to put it into proper context and to see that, oh, okay, I discovered the truth. But you know what? Nobody has a monopoly on the truth. No culture, no religion, no one mystic, not the Buddha, not Christ, not anybody. And a truly enlightened master will not claim to have a monopoly on the truth. If they do, that's how you can tell that they're still ignorant and they still don't have the most integrated, biggest picture perspective possible. And that's one of the traps that I see people falling into when they listen to me talking about enlightenment, is that they get on board, they start to do some meditation techniques, they maybe even have an insight or two, maybe they do some psychedelics or whatever, and then all of a sudden they get cocky and they think that they understand non-duality and they think that their particular method was the one right method. And then they start criticizing and bickering about how, oh no, that teacher over there, he's wrong. And Leo, what you're saying here is egotistical and this over there and that over there. And so you start to fight with everybody. And believe it or not, this happens to even enlightened people, is that because they are ignorant of the bigger picture, they can go on a crusade to spread their enlightenment. Because you know what? Yeah, it feels like you've got the truth, and maybe you do got the truth. But you got to understand that there are many different paths up the mountaintop. It's the same fucking mountaintop. Just because you took one path doesn't mean that's the one path that everybody should take. Different people resonate with different paths. Different people are from different cultures. What I want to help you to do here is to become sort of a cosmopolitan non-dualist rather than a parochial non-dualist. It's sort of like you're becoming a citizen of the world. And this is actually very important, because otherwise, if you don't do this, what will happen to you is that you will get triggered. One day you'll be discussing non-duality with somebody and they'll be from a different culture, from a different tradition, have different preferences and stylistic differences from you. And then you guys are going to get into some heated debate when in fact there's nothing to debate. You both agree on the fundamental truth. But the ego loves to debate, doesn't it? The ego loves to play sectarian games. The ego loves to say, oh, Leo, you just said, you know, the Sufis discovered the truth. And, you know, I'm Islamic. So, Leo, does that mean that Islam is the one true religion? That's what it means. That's what you said. And that's not at all what I said. Yeah, it's true that there are some people in the Sufi tradition who have discovered the ultimate absolute truth of existence. And so that's a part of Islam. It's also true, though, that there are Buddhists who have discovered the ultimate truth. It's also true that there are Hindus who have discovered the ultimate truth. There are Jews who have discovered the ultimate truth. There are Christians. There are atheists. There are occultists. There are Africans. There are Native Americans. Okay? And I want you to be comfortable with that so that you don't cling to your little corner of the world and then try to proselytize everybody to follow your style. You have to leave room open for stylistic differences. In the same way that, you know, when you travel to another country, you accept that they have different cuisine, different customs, different culture, different etiquette, right? And the wrong way to travel would be to say, like, you know what? I live in America, so I'm going to go to Asia. And when I'm in Asia, I'm going to try to impose all the American values, American culture, American cuisine on the Asians, because the Asians got it wrong. No, see, that's just a lack of worldliness. That's something that happens to somebody who's lived in America his whole life and then maybe travels to Asia once. And then he looks like a fucking fool, right? So you don't want to do that with your non-duality. You want to be much more accepting. And also, it's important because this actually leads to a lot of suffering and damage when you don't have this cosmopolitan big picture perspective. Why? Well, just take a look through the last 5,000 years of history. What has it been? It's mostly been, history books are filled with what? With spiritual crusades and all manner of evil in the name of spirituality. Wars, torture, inquisitions, trials, persecution, segregation, like all these things. Why? Because our ancestors didn't have the big picture cosmopolitan perspective. Now, we can forgive them, though. Why? Because, frankly, you know, 2,000 years ago, what was happening? There was no internet. There were no airplanes. There were no airports. There were no trains, no automobiles. So, if you became enlightened in your little corner of the world, you didn't even know that the world was freaking round and that there were other races on the other end of the world. You didn't know that. And there weren't very good books in print. There wasn't the internet where you can go and learn all this stuff. So it was very difficult to get a big picture cosmopolitan perspective back then. So we understand, you know, society had to evolve to where we are now. But you are different. You are alive in the 21st century. We now have the luxury of the internet and so forth. And it's very easy to learn about these things. So you really have no more excuses to be sectarian. You need to be cosmopolitan because that's ultimate non-duality. Non-duality is not about saying, oh, I'm a Buddhist and the Buddhists are right and everybody else is wrong. No, that's antithetical to real non-duality. Real non-duality is embodied, not just known or spoken. And to embody it means that everything is one. And if everything is one, that means the Buddhists, the Muslims, the Hindus, the atheists, the Egyptians, the Jews, everybody. They're all your neighbors. They're all your neighbors. And as Jesus said, treat your neighbors as you would treat yourself. That's very important. It's very important that you understand this. This is not just a philosophical, pedantic, philosophical, or like a scholarly point. Okay. All right. So enough of me ranting about that. Let me sum up just by saying what your biggest takeaway here should be. This is a good start. But what I need you to do, if you're on board with becoming a sage, is to go and research this stuff a little deeper. Because this was just a really quick overview. I want you to become familiar with the language of non-duality. All the different labels and words that I mentioned. All the different traditions. At least have a cursory overview. Now, don't get me wrong. I'm not saying that what you need to do is to become a master in every single tradition and field. There's virtually no way that you'll be able to do that. Nor am I saying that you need to pursue all the techniques in all the different fields to become enlightened. That would also be misguided. You need to select one or two or three sets of techniques and just work those. And the most important thing that I want you to take away here is that this is all about having a direct experience for yourself. The practical benefit that I can see to understanding this bigger picture and to studying these traditions is that actually it produces motivation within you. Because here's what will happen. You start to study and read this stuff. You start to make all the interconnections between all these different traditions. And then it hits you like, oh my God, all these people over the last 5,000 years on every continent around the world have all been talking about the same damn thing. And it's an experience. They're talking about an experience. They're not talking about a belief system. It's an experience. And I don't have a reference for all these labels. I'm missing this reference experience. I don't have an experience. I don't know what the ultimate nature of existence is. If I'm honest, I don't know. That's what I want you to experience, is that state of not knowing, that realization that there's something bigger, something esoteric about life that you don't yet know. Because that is the true beginning of the spiritual path, is when you get to that point. And we need a lot more people getting to that point. Okay. So you can think of this as an exercise in building your motivation, as it also opens your mind and makes you more cosmopolitan. And then the most ultimate takeaway is that after you do this research and you study these traditions, is that here would be the mistake, is if you did that and then you became the academic scholarly know-it-all trying to impress your friends with trivial facts about these different traditions. It's like, oh, did you know the Hindus and did you know the Islamics and did you know this and this and this? That would be a mistake. The point here is that you study all this stuff and then you recognize that now I need the direct experience of what the fuck all these people are talking about. I need to know. It's almost like, you know, if your friends went to see some great new movie that came out and they just loved it. It's like the best movie ever, the best movie of the year, right? And they all talk about it at work with you. Like, oh man, you got to go see this movie. You got to see this movie. It's like, it's so funny. They start telling jokes from the movie and they start making little allusions to, oh, this happened and that happened. But you, not having seen the movie, you kind of get it, but really you don't, right? You can't laugh at the jokes. You can't really appreciate the things they're talking about. You just get a little outsider's perspective. So what does that usually do? Well, that gets you excited to go see the movie, right? And then you go see the movie. So that's the idea here. The mistake would be to get caught up in all the stories about the movie, go read online reviews about the movie, and then say, oh yeah, you know, I've read all the online reviews, so I don't need to go see the movie. That would be the deadly mistake. And I don't want you to make that mistake here, right? So be careful. All right, so that's it. But I'm going to leave you with the following homework assignment. I have some Wikipedia links, a couple dozen of them that I'm going to post down below this video. Go peruse these links. These links point to many of the words about enlightenment that I talked about in this episode. They also point you to different specific mystical traditions that I want you to research because I don't think you've ever studied them. They didn't teach you this stuff in school. They didn't teach you this stuff in college, most likely. So you just don't know, right? So go and spend a couple hours, at least, perusing these links, reading through them. And as you're doing that, look for the commonalities. The commonalities. And that will create a really nice foundation for you then to go out and pursue enlightenment in whichever way you want. And then you can select, you know, which methods and techniques you want to use. And you're going to be much more likely to find the tradition and the methods and techniques that will appeal and resonate with you. All right? So that's it. If you do this, a whole new world will open up to you. Non-duality is an entire field. It's a very rich and beautiful field to study. It's the most meaningful thing to study. That's why mankind has been ranting and raving over spirituality since the dawn of time. That's why. because this is what you're here to understand. So now's the best time to begin. All right, I'm signing off. Click the like button for me, please. Post your comments down below. Share this episode with a friend. And lastly, come check out actualize.org right here. This is my website. Sign up to my newsletter. It's free. Stay tuned with me, as in the future, I will be releasing more and more topics about how to become a sage. And it's going to be deeper and deeper topics like this. If you dug this topic, you're going to dig a lot of the stuff I'm going to be sharing with you in the future. And it's going to be a mix of sort of abstract, philosophical, intellectual stuff, but then also practical stuff. And when you blend the theory with the practice, that's when you get the strongest combination. Just doing the practice with no theory, that is not the strongest combination. You'll discover that as we go along, because you'll see some of the topics, the very conceptual topics that I'll share with you in the future, will be absolutely instrumental to your success on this path and in your life. So I hope you stick with me, and I'll see you soon with more.